crash, bash, mash, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We want the crowd loud, fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want, we want, we want, we want, we want, we want, we want. Liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today on the program, we begin by speaking with the Associate Director of Project Censored, Andy Lee Roth. He's building an interactive resource on algorithmic literacy for journalists. In the next segment of the program, we're joined by Maya Shenwar of Truthout and Laura Witt of Prism. We'll talk about the Movement Media Alliance, how movement media organizations are coming together to build power in a coalition working to build a journalism of accountability based on social justice. Stay tuned for an all-new Project Censored show coming up next. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today, in the first segment of the program, we are delighted to bring back the Associate Director of Project Censored, Dr. Andy Lee Roth. Andy has co-edited 14 editions of Project Censored Yearbook, including the last one, which was State of the Free Press 2024. Andy and I, along with Shaylee Voidel, have recently completed the next one, which will be out in December, State of the Free Press 2025. Andy Lee Roth is also co-author of The Media and Me, A Guide to Critical Media Literacy for Young People. Roth also coordinates Project Censored's Campus Affiliates Program, a news media research network of several hundred students and faculty at 24 colleges and universities across North America. His research and writing have been published in a variety of outlets, including Index on Censorship, In These Times, Yes Magazine, Truthout, Media, Culture, and Society, the International Journal of Press and Politics, The Progressive, and more. Andy holds a PhD in sociology from the University of California, Los Angeles, a BA in sociology and anthropology from Haverford College. Andy also serves on the boards of the Media Freedom Foundation, Weave News, and of course, the Censored Press. And Andy Lee Roth, the reason that we're bringing you onto the show today, we're certainly going to have you back coming up here later in the fall for the book release. But you are the recipient of a very prestigious fellowship from the Reynolds Journalism Institute, and you're building an interactive resource on algorithmic literacy for journalists. And I'm talking to you during Media Literacy Week. This show will air the following week. And even though a lot of the work that we've done at Project Censored around critical media literacy education, we've done quite a bit of it, focusing on students and trying to help teachers. But this is a different angle. This is specifically targeting algorithmic literacy for journalists. And you're developing a resource that will help develop journalists' ability to understand the functions, consequences, and ethics of algorithms in a digital age. Very important and groundbreaking work. A core focus of the project will be helping independent journalists in newsrooms whose digital content has been subject to shadow banning, demonetization, and other forms of online speech filtering that restrict them from reaching a wider audience. And you've been publishing monthly various articles as part of your fellowship. Andy Lee Roth, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks so much, Mickey, and happy to be here today.
It's always great to sit down and talk to you about this work in a way where we can share it with a broad audience. And again, I'm really excited about the work that's happening with your fellowship. You can start just by talking a little bit about the Reynolds Journalism Institute and what this fellowship is.
So first of all, the Reynolds Journalism Institute promotes innovation that ultimately aims to strengthen journalism's future. The Institute is based at the University of Missouri. The Reynolds Journalism Institute was established in 2008, which was the 100th anniversary of the School of Journalism at the University of Missouri, which makes it one of the oldest formal journalism schools in the world. So every year, the Reynolds Journalism Institute puts out a call for proposals for projects that will serve that mission of strengthening journalism's future by coming up with innovations. This year, we were fortunate enough to be selected. The project's proposal to promote algorithmic literacy for journalists was one of 200-some applications that RJI received, and we were one of seven projects that the Institute decided to fund for the 2024-2025 fellowship year. So it's a real honor to have been selected, and I'm finding that just as working with Project Censored does, being able to say that you're working with the Reynolds Journalism Institute has a way of opening doors that might otherwise be hard to get through. And probably it could be a fantastic future episode of the Project Censored Show to feature some of the other RJI fellows and the work they're doing. It really is, in my experience so far, we were all together in Columbia, Missouri, on the University of Missouri campus at the RJI facilities this last July, and meeting my fellow fellows was really inspiring and also motivating because there's so much really strong cutting edge work going on. And I'm doing my best with colleagues here on the team at Project Censored to make algorithmic literacy for journalists live up to that idea of promoting innovation that strengthens journalism.
Absolutely. And again, our listeners that want to look more into this, you can go to rjionline.org. And again, as Andy said, it's the Reynolds Journalism Institute, part of the University of Missouri. We're going to reference several of the pieces that Andy's been working on. But before we get into more of the specifics, let's just start a basic overview. Andy, what is algorithmic literacy? So talk to our audience a little bit about what exactly you're working on.
So algorithmic literacy is an umbrella term. It's really talking about multiple literacies. It's also an evolving idea. And so it may be useful to just, before talking about what algorithmic literacy is, to just back up one step and say, well, what's an algorithm in the first place? You can think of algorithms as being almost like a cookbook recipe. It's a designed process or a set of rules, in this case, not for creating a dish or making a cake or something, but for analyzing data, for analyzing and organizing data. And algorithms are, in effect, baked into, to continue my food metaphors here, many of the tools that we use on the daily. Things like the news feed on a social media account, what's going on when you use a search engine to look up when was the last time the Dodgers and Yankees met in the World Series, and so forth and so on. So when we talk about algorithmic literacy, we're talking about a set of skills that enable the individuals who possess them to critically evaluate algorithms and algorithmic technologies and to use those tools in an ethical way. So in that sense, algorithmic literacy is part of the critical media literacy programs that Project Censored does. And in fact, you know, you mentioned The Media and Me, our book about critical media literacy for young people. There's actually a fairly substantial section in The Media and Me about algorithms and about, in effect, algorithmic literacy. So if we're talking about algorithmic literacy for the general public, I think one of the reasons we need algorithmic literacy is to avoid extremes, to avoid the hyperbolic discourse of the people who are the AI doomers, the ones who are saying it's all going to be like Terminator 2, the algorithms, the AIs are going to take over and will end the world. But they're also on the opposite end of the hyperbolic scale, the ones who would propose to us that algorithms and AI systems more generally are going to solve all our problems. And if we're going to navigate the extremes of the doomers and the boomers, we've got to have not just media literacy, but specifically algorithmic literacy to parse those things. Now, as you mentioned, Mickey, this project is specifically for journalists, and it's targeting the day-to-day practices of journalists. I think in the 21st century, every journalist needs to have some degree of algorithmic literacy in order to do their job. This includes not only their daily routines that are kind of behind the scenes, but also their ability to inform the public. And as algorithms determine more and more how news is gathered, how news is produced, how it's distributed, and how people consume it, there are real questions about the transparency and the accountability of the news production process. And so that's the kind of deep motivation for the Algorithmic Literacy for Journalists project.
You have several installments at the RJI site. You're writing monthly sort of reports that have a certain focus. And this week, when the show airs, you're going to have yet another one that's out that we'll talk about here momentarily. But more specifically, can you talk about, and I know we've written about this before, and certainly you've written about this for years now, the new gatekeepers. And we've written about big tech and new kinds of censorship. How do big tech algorithms play a role here as the new gatekeepers? Can you introduce that, actually reintroduce it, because we've addressed it before on the program. But could you remind our listeners what that focus is?
One of the challenges for journalists now is that insofar as more and more Americans are getting their news via social media platforms or through the use of search engines, things like online likes and shares have become a kind of new currency for journalists and editors. And there's more and more temptation for journalists and editors to chase after likes and shares, leading to the concern that these kind of promotional motives and pressures are going to preempt, traditional journalistic values and traditional journalistic craft. But there's a deeper concern that you point to, Mikia, and your intro flagged this, which is that algorithmic gatekeeping now threatens to filter news about politics and social justice issues. And so we know, for instance, that news aggregators like Apple News and Google News have been found to skew towards soft news stories drawn from a narrow range of sources. We also know, and this is research that our colleague Avram Anderson and I have done in the past, that Google News tends to highlight biased content, including stories that reflect and promote anti-LGBTQ prejudice. And our colleagues Emil Marmol and Lee Major, in I think it was the 2020 Censored Yearbook, wrote about some of these new restrictions being a kind of Trojan horse. And specifically, what they found was dozens of cases. This is Mamol and Major, found dozens of cases where alternative media voices from the libertarian right to the anarchist left were being either deplatformed or deranked, with the result being that independent news coverage of issues like systemic racism, environmental degradation, class struggle, illegal surveillance, violence by state actors domestically and abroad, corporate malfeasance, all these were subject to online censorship. So, a really critical dimension of algorithmic literacy, as I understand it, is to talk about not just ideas of algorithmic bias, which are certainly real and important, but also to talk about how algorithms constitute a new means of censorship. That's an important, but I think underemphasized component of a lot of algorithmic literacy training.
Andy Lee Roth, I know we started our conversation, you were talking about what algorithms were, but these aren't just things that make themselves, they're created. So can you at least briefly address what makes algorithms problematic in a journalistic sense?
Or just in a sociological sense, part of it is who are the people who are designing them? We tend to talk about algorithms, and you'll see this very frequently in press coverage. News stories about algorithms will often talk about algorithms as black boxes, with the idea that we can't know how they work. And to some extent, that's true. Algorithms are protected by the people who develop them, the companies that develop them as proprietary information. And in that sense, how they actually work is only indirectly known to most of us. But the reason that they're black boxes is part of the power equation and part of what I think, if we talk about algorithmic literacy as the ability to critically evaluate these technologies, well, part of that critical understanding includes why they're black boxes. They aren't black boxes because of technical reasons, they're black boxes because of power concerns. And these big platforms, Meta and Google and Microsoft, aren't interested in opening up the algorithms to third-party inspection for bias. There have been multiple class action lawsuits by content creators, for example, on YouTube, trying to get access to the YouTube algorithm, not public access, but simply access to an independent third party to inspect the algorithm. And time and again, the courts have decided in favor of the big tech platforms. So that's part of the power dynamics that go in some ways way beyond the scope of the Algorithmic Literacy for Journalists project, but certainly have to be part of any meaningful discussion we have. One of the most fundamental questions that I think journalists can ask and that members of the public can also ask when we talk about algorithms is, how does the introduction of this new technology shift power? And certainly one of the ways that power is shifted is when developers use the notion of intellectual property and proprietary control of these algorithms. But that's perpetuated. That's perpetuated and in some sense enabled when journalists accept the idea of algorithms as black boxes without critically asking questions about why that's so.
In other words, this is more of the justification for why the project you're undertaking is to provide this kind of context, background, education, and tools, for lack of a better term, so that journalists might better understand them, and maybe it'll lead them to ask different questions, more probing questions.
Yeah. At Project Censored, most of our media literacy programming is designed for teachers and their students. And teachers are, of course, incredibly busy and incredibly time pressured. But if that's true for educators, it's incredibly true for journalists who work on tremendous daily deadline pressure. So they don't have a lot of time to onboard new information. And so one of the goals of this project is to kind of synthesize a bunch of the best practices and leading understandings of these issues and package it in a format that will be easy for journalists to access and digest and incorporate into their daily work routines. And so one critical dimension of that is simply asking when they are talking about, when they're reporting stories about AI or algorithms in particular, simple things that they can do to make that reporting more useful to the public, better, more informing. So one of them is avoiding characterizing algorithms as inscrutable black boxes. Another is to avoid reporting based primarily on industry press releases or industry spokespeople. This is the old problem that we talk about all the time at Project Censored, about the quality of the journalism is only as good as the diverse range of sources that journalists treat as newsworthy. And when journalists reporting on the latest AI tech developments ask only industry insiders about how that tech is going to work or what the promise of that tech is, we're obviously going to get a partial, that is to say, incomplete and probably biased understanding of what's possible there. And so the ability to talk to people from outside industry who nonetheless have expertise is a major way that journalism about algorithms and AI more generally can be improved.
We're speaking with Dr. Andy Lee Roth. He is the Associate Director of Project Censored. And we're speaking more specifically about the role that Andy is in this year. He is a fellow at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. He is developing tools on algorithmic literacy for journalists. What he's developing here, it's a resource to help develop journalists' ability to understand the functions, consequences, and ethics of algorithms in a digital age. More specifically, Andy, you've been writing several pieces, some co-authored with some other allies at Project Censored and folks that have been working with us for some time. You've written a couple pieces. And again, I want to remind our listeners, you can go to rjionline.org to find these particular articles. In addition to writing about big tech algorithms as the new gatekeepers, you've written how to conduct a DIY algorithm audit. You've also written about recognizing and responding to shadow bans. And then most recently, you've been writing about lessons from horse race reporting on elections. So let's talk a little bit about a couple of the specifics, Andy. Highlight a few specifics for us so our listeners can see how you're applying this.
Algorithm audits are one technique that people interested in algorithmic accountability use to get around the black box problem that we were talking about earlier. An algorithm audit is a method of repeatedly varying inputs to observe variations in the algorithm's outputs. So it kind of works around the so-called black box to say we can control what we put in and we'll see how the algorithm responds. Almost all algorithm audits share one or two common goals, which is to draw conclusions about the algorithm's inner workings and also about its potentially problematic outputs. And so one of the articles that we did, part of the toolkit that we're developing, Avram Anderson, who's a library and information science faculty member at Cal State University Northridge, longtime Project Censored contributor, and Avram and I have worked on a bunch of projects together. And Avram stepped in to help with some of the technical aspects of this that are beyond my skill set. We wrote basically a guide, a six-step guide to how to conduct an algorithm audit as a way that journalists can produce newsworthy reporting about the function of algorithms. I will add quickly that for a more general audience, it's possible to do DIY algorithms, do it yourself. The idea is you don't have to have a lot of specialized technical skills or equipment to do a DIY algorithm audit. We lay out six steps that most anyone who wanted to take the time to do it could do. The primary aim in the context of the RJI Fellowship is to encourage more journalists to use this tool themselves in their own reporting, but it's also a tool that has general applicability. Avram and I have published several pieces where the core findings of the story have been based on algorithm audits that we've conducted. I mentioned the Google News and anti-LGBTQ content, and those findings are ones we published a few years ago now in the Index to Censorship using an algorithm audit. More recently, Shaylee Voydal, Project Censored's digital and print editor, and I are just completing an article looking at horse race coverage of elections. Mickey, you and I have written some about this in the context of the current presidential election for the Progressive magazine. We know horse race coverage of elections is deeply flawed. And the upshot of the article that Shaylee Voydal and I worked on is to look at lessons from flawed election coverage that uses horse race metaphors to improve reporting on new developments in AI technology, which often uses some of the same kind of horse race type conventions to characterize AI tech in terms of competition between either tech firms or nations to the detriment of the public's understanding of what these new AI technology developments might actually entail.
Andy Roth, in that piece with you and Shaylee Voydal, you actually reference when you're talking about the horse race metaphor, there was an inclusion of how people that cover horse races had views on how that was being used in politics.
We know a lot about what's wrong about horse race coverage of elections. I won't try to summarize the vast findings there, except to say there's substantial research documenting that the voting public, electoral candidates, and the news industry itself all suffer when journalists cover elections using horse race frames. So the article you're alluding to, Mickey, is a piece by a journalist named Annie Aguilar, who earlier this year filed a great report for Pointer. What Aguiar did is talk to actual horse race journalists, people who cover horse racing as reporters for a living, to ask them what they made of actual horse race election coverage. And it's a really clever article. And if you point your web browser to Pointer and look for what do horse race journalists think of horse race journalism, you'll find yourself a very interesting read. So, election coverage, we're in the midst of a fierce election, a fierce, consequential, fateful election season right now. We're seeing no shortage of horse race coverage. But the kind of starting point for the article that Shaylee and I have written is that horse race metaphors, or a variant on them, arms race metaphors, are rife in most news reporting about AI tech developments. So, is Apple being left behind in the development of programs like ChatGPT and so forth and so on? And you see the same kind of language and metaphors that we see in election coverage being duplicated in journalism about AI tech developments. with, we argue, the same problem. Journalists rely on this trope because it's attractive and simple to understand, but it leaves the public with an incomplete understanding of what the implications of these tech developments actually are.
And you have some tips for improved coverage. You don't just call out the issue as like, hey, this is a problem. You and Shaley Voigt will actually have some suggestions about how issues around AI could be covered, including exposing bias in AI systems. Or you mentioned about how it is very difficult for policymakers to keep up with the technology itself. These are very reasonable issues, and you're trying to come up with pragmatic ways to address them.
Yeah. One of our recommendations is just about language use. We recommend being cautious of equating a development in AI tech with an advance or progress. Just because it's a development doesn't mean it's an advance, doesn't mean it's progress. But racing metaphors facilitate kind of unjustified claims about future progress, because in a horse race, the horses are always moving towards the finish line. But tech doesn't develop that way. As Sayash Kapoor, who's one of the authors of a fantastic new book, AI Snake Oil, put it to us, horse races are run on tracks where progress happens in straight lines. But that's not true for AI progress. And so these kind of equating any development in AI technology with an advance or with progress is one of the ways we get kind of this hyperbolic public discussion about algorithms and AI more generally, right? The idea that it's you know, this is the road to the apocalypse or this is the road to salvation. Either of those come when we don't critically assess, is this development actually an advance? Does this represent progress? And understand how important, when we talk about media literacy in general, that in the current day and age, algorithmic literacy is such an important component of critical media literacy.
Very important new research you're doing, and the creation of these kinds of lessons, algorithmic literacy for journalists. This is a pioneering and very important development. So it's fantastic that you have been honored with this fellowship with the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Of course, you can learn more about the work Andy does at ProjectCensored.org. He's the associate director of Project Censored, co-editor most recently of State of the Free Press 2024, and co-author of The Media and Me, A Guide to Critical Media Literacy for Young People. Andy, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
Thanks a bunch, Mickey.
Coming up next, I'll be talking about a new media movement alliance. Stay tuned after this brief musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Today in this segment, for the second half of the program, I am honored to bring two amazing people that are veterans of the indie media universe, Maya Shenhwar from truthout.org. And of course, folks listening to this show know that we have referenced Truthout and their excellent work for ages. And we're also joined by Laura Witt of Prism. We're going to have a really wonderful conversation about new developments in the independent media ecosystem. Both Maya and Laura have been really key figures and instrumental in launching a movement media alliance, which I think is just long overdue, coming in the shadows, of course, of things like the Media Consortium and other kinds of efforts to sort of do the cat herding in the indie media world. That's a phrase that will probably come up again. But we have a lot of really amazing things to talk about from our guests. So let me introduce them. Maya Shenhua is the director of Truth Out Center for Grassroots Journalism, also Truth Out's editor at large and board president. Maya is co-editor of the forthcoming We Grow the World Together, Parenting Toward Abolition. And we'll certainly be having Maya back on about that book release in the very near future. Maya is also co-author of Prison by Any Other Name, The Harmful Consequences of Popular Reforms, author of Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better, co-editor of the Truth Out anthology, Who Do You Serve? Who Do You Protect? Police Violence and Resistance in the United States. In addition to Truth Out, Maya's work has appeared in many publications, including The New York Times, The Guardian, NBC News, and The Nation. She has appeared on Democracy Now!, MSNBC, C-SPAN, and NPR, other television and radio programs. Maya Shenhua is co-founder of the Movement Media Alliance, MMA, and Media Against Apartheid and Displacement, MAAD. Plenty of reasons for us to get mad. Maya Shenhua, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks so much, Mickey.
It is my pleasure. And also, please allow me to introduce Lara Witt, an award-winning editor and journalist, the editor-in-chief of Prism, co-founder of the Movement Media Alliance and Media Against Apartheid Displacement that I just mentioned. And their goal is to provide platforms for marginalized voices and to reshape the landscape of media altogether as a tool for liberation. So it's no surprise to the Project Censored audience that, of course, you're likely familiar with both Prism and Truth Out. Certainly have been discussed on the pages of Project Censored. I lost track of how many Truth Out stories have made it into our top lists every year. And this year will probably be no exception. Maya Shenhua, let's start with you. I'm very excited and interested in the movement media organizations that are coming together to build a new kind of power. The Movement Media Alliance is a coalition working to build a journalism of accountability based on social justice. It's certainly about time. You both wrote an article back in August this year announcing this at truthout.org. Maya, tell us a little bit about this, how this came together.
The Movement Media Alliance, which launched at the end of this past summer, is this coalition of journalism organizations that are specifically social justice driven and independent. And over the past year, a few of us, including initially folks from In These Times and Convergence and Truth Out, started thinking about what it might look like to bring in a bunch of people from movement-driven media organizations around the country, bring people together to kind of think about the moment we're in. And at the time, so this was over a year ago, when we talked about the moment, we were talking about looming fascism. And coming together to think about the fact that we all have been operating in our separate little silos as news organizations, doing parallel work, oftentimes doing overlapping work, but not necessarily thinking about each other or supporting each other or even amplifying each other, even though there's this real potential to actually uplift each other's work in an environment where there is so much competition and so many opportunities to be drowned out. And we really need the left to be coming together and uplifting each other's messages. And I think the other goal here, if we're really, really honest, is we wanted to help each other not die. So we're seeing all of these organizations, these great, amazing left, progressive journalism organizations that had been around for many years, just crumbling and falling due to financial constraints, due to all kinds of political repression, due to repression on social media that made it hard to access audience and traffic. And all of these factors kind of coming together in a tough political climate. And we saw outlets dying, doing mass layoffs, having to scale way back, changing their missions. And we thought, okay, we've got to come together. We cover organizing all the time. We have to organize among ourselves. So we came together for an initial convening in 2023 in November. And initially, we had planned to mostly talk about how are we going to face down looming fascism and how are we going to support each other financially and structurally. And we ended up actually spending most of the time talking about covering Palestine together because it was a month into this escalated genocide. And we were grappling with the fact that not only were we individually experiencing repression as media organizations actually covering the genocide, but that most media organizations were actively doing work to fuel the genocide. Lara will tell you more about that, but with Media Against Apartheid and Displacement. But this was an example of a moment for us where we said, okay, we as movement media organizations are stronger together. We can build opportunities for us to uplift each other's work at a time when it's being suppressed, to build on each other's narratives and collaborate with each other editorially at times when, we're never going to have as much reach as the New York Times individually, but together we can. So as we move forward, we're thinking about both those kinds of editorial collaborations and how we can support each other in really concrete ways to become more sustainable so we can stick around and do this work into the future.
So many important points that you just hit, and especially on the left, getting people together. But the left has this bad habit of getting into a circular firing squad where people spend more time almost sniping at each other over their one disagreement than working together toward common cause. And my goodness, if you didn't just list several common causes that we face and struggles from censorship and shadow banning to struggle with independent financing, just keeping the lights on, keeping this kind of work going. We really have challenges. And then there's the global challenges, certainly what's happening in Gaza. It's on our minds a lot. We've done so many shows on this. The Committee to Protect Journalists says we have record numbers, horrific number of deaths of journalists and media workers, specifically in Gaza, at least 128, but it's certainly more than that, certainly more than the 42,000 dead innocent people. It's an absolute calamity. We have a lot to be reporting about in terms of social justice. And if we can't come together now during these major crises, and of course, here we are again on the cusp of another, what shouldn't be a nail-biting election with bad choices all around, this really is a time, I think, for independent media to organize, to get together, and really use this moment to move forward. Laura Witt, let's bring you into the conversation.
Thank you. Yeah, Media Against Apartheid and Displacement came out of that need for a place where people can find reliable, trustworthy journalism on what was happening in Gaza and throughout Palestine itself. And also to be able to give an American audience that has been misled and also very much lied to about the realities of Palestine and Israel. We're up against undoing a lot of Zionist narratives. And so our work was to be able to show people that a lot of what they had learned wasn't true. And that the apartheid regime that Palestinians live under is one that it does exist. So what MAD does is provide people with a centralized location where our media organization's work is represented and updated on a regular basis so that there is a hub where they can go to read and inform themselves and listen. It's the first project of its kind that gathers now 21 different media organizations under a shared goal and shared mission with a shared mission statement that is staunchly anti-Zionist, pro-Palestinian, pro-liberation, anti-settler colonial. And that's rare for media spaces, which obviously use the mythology of objectivity to create both sidism and to launder and manufacture consent for genocide and other atrocities that we see in this world. So it was a massive undertaking. We decided that November was a good time to start working on this project. So we discussed it during our first convening of the Movement Media Alliance. When we weren't titled the Movement Media Alliance yet, we just knew that we wanted to work with each other. so desperately, and that this could be like a good first project to work on together to see what sort of collaborations can come of it, but also to provide a space for us to not just work, but also to be with each other, to comfort each other, to provide each other with a safe space to vent, to figure out and strategize, and also just have fun. There are so few spaces in media that are fun. And the ones that we've been able to build with each other have just been very joyous and have provided like a sanctuary during times that are difficult for us as media workers to get through. So not only are we doing excellent work, but we're also providing each other with a lot of comfort care, which then enables us to do even better work. You know, so much of our imagination and our creativity can get sapped by constant chaos and dread and hopelessness. So the spaces in which we can create comfort and a shared politic and organizing, really, it's an antidote to a lot of the despair that we've been experiencing.
That's a wonderful term, antidote. And the idea of doing this in a space that encourages self-care at a time when things are so really off the rails, it's very hard to process this kind of tragic and traumatic information. As you mentioned, it's hard enough to get information out to the rest of the world. Certainly the corporate media from their Tony studios in Jerusalem and wherever, going through IDF and Israeli government censors, you know, the paper of record is telling a very different story than the kind of stories that you see at your organizations. Just very quickly, the website for Media Against Apartheid and Displacement is themad.org, correct? M-A-A-D.
Yes.
Certainly, that's one of the websites that we're referring to right now. Laura, the other organization where you're editor-in-chief is prismreports.org. I want to make sure that folks are very aware of where to go and find this information. And of course, people have likely heard of truthout.org. Laura, just continuing with you for a minute, you mentioned 21 organizations that are together in this. Who's part of this coalition? How did that come together? You probably see room for more growth or including people that are also already doing this kind of work.
It was easier to start with the first members of Media Against Apartheid and Displacement because a lot of them were already in the room with us when we were talking about creating this hub. So the first ones that were on board were Convergence Magazine, Haymarket Books, In These Times, The Dig, Waging Nonviolence, Prism, of course, The Forge. Then we had Truth Out, The Real News Network. Those were the founding members of MAD. And then we wanted to, of course, bring in people who were based in Palestine, in the occupied Palestinian territories, or whose work, whose sole mission was to cover what was happening in Palestine from the beginning. We wanted to work with Palestinian editors and reporters. So we contacted the Institute for Palestine Studies. They have a English language blog that is a part of that is headed up by Laura Albast. It's called Palestine Square. And we had started sharing so many of their pieces to MAD anyways. We brought on Mondo Vice, and then we brought on smaller publications that are all movement journalism aligned. So places like Briar Patch, the Kansas City Defender, the Public Source, which is based in Beirut in Lebanon, The Objective, and of course, Analyst News. And a couple podcasts too. So we have folks from a small podcast called Millennials Are Killing Capitalism. They do really excellent analysis. And I've been a huge fan of theirs for such a long time. So it was such an honor that they joined us. Hammer and Hope joined us recently as well. This growing collective is very empowering. It's showing us there is a strong contingent of publications that are doing the kind of work that is exceptionally necessary in this moment, and that we don't have to rely on mainstream media sources. There are places that you can go to, and we're just trying to make it as easy as possible for people to find them.
You know, Maya Shenwar, if only the corporate media could find these websites. How is it that we're out here doing this? We know about it. You're all doing this. You're all rattling off names. I mean, there are even more groups and people that are doing things. But yet all the folks out there in the corporate media universe, they don't seem to know we're here.
We get these little inklings that they know we're here when they either poach our stories or they'll grab little tidbits that we've broken or things we've exposed. And sometimes they'll throw us a link. And sometimes our goal really is to catapult an issue into the mainstream. And we certainly celebrate it, even if we're not given full credit. I think that they do kind of know we're here, but I think it is a matter of how the institutions of journalism are viewed, the idea of what journalism is supposed to be. And this idea of objectivity, which we've touched on a couple of times today, that holds that truth is not about the things that we talk about within MMA, accuracy, accountability, transparency, principled journalism that's values driven. It's not about that. It's about quote unquote balance for a lot of these mainstream publications, which means if you interview someone who's not a fascist, then you also have to interview a fascist to balance them out. And you can't give one more space than the other. That wouldn't be fair. So in those kinds of ways, truth is actually really distorted.
George Seldes in the mid-20th century was clear about this, saying like, look, the job of journalists isn't to be, quote, objective. It's to tell the public what's really going on. It's to inform the public in a meaningful way that leads to civic engagement. And that means telling oftentimes uncomfortable truths. It means often offending the very people that own the press. As A.J. Liebling quipped, you know, the best way to ensure freedom of the press is to own one. And unfortunately, we still live in that kind of world in some ways. But in other ways, the work that you're both doing and these great coalitions that you're bringing together, you're reminding us that journalism is something for everyone and it is in the public interest. And that these organizations that you're working with under the MMA umbrella, they all have this moral compass that's going in this direction. It's looking at what's really going on around the world that needs to be addressed and what can be done about it. Laura Witt, you mentioned earlier in the conversation the challenges of objectivity. And again, on the surface, you're like, well, the implication of being not objective is that you're wrong or that there's some flawed issue. Yet we don't see anybody calling out the lack of objectivity in corporate media when they both side things to death, quite literally, even if the evidence is on one side of an issue. The climate crisis screams to mind over the last couple of decades. But Laura, let's bring you back in here and talk a little bit more about some of those issues and how the work of MMA, the work of MAD is really doing something different. And I'd love to bring in some more of the concepts of media literacy and education as to how that informs this reporting. Laura Witt, please.
Yeah. There's a quote that sits above my desk that a friend sent me on a postcard. It's a quote by Ruben Salazar. Newsroom objectivity may result in an absence of truth. That is indeed the case. So PRISM itself is led by BIPOC reporters, so Black, Indigenous, and people of color reporters. Our entire newsroom is staffed by BIPOC. And it's not that necessarily rooted in like representational politics, but it's just the understanding that people of color and that marginalized people are best positioned to cover the issues that are affecting their communities. Not only because we have shared experience and shared culture, but also because we understand the nuances of our different cultures and we just are very best positioned to see and understand and share accurately the things that are happening to us. They don't get like muddled or lost in a translation of whitewashing. And our stories are also not going to be positioned within a context that questions the integrity of our experiences, that questions us, our humanity as people. So often Black and Brown voices are doubted or they're like framed around police quotes or politicians who frankly don't give a f about them and only court them when it comes to voting. And so our position at PRISM or our mission at PRISM is to ensure that not only are we doing justice to our communities, but that the sort of stories that we cover ensure that people are going to be deeply engaged in their communities and are going to be incentivized to organize around the issues that are affecting them. So not just like, you know, once every 4 years at the ballot box, you drop in your little thing and you f off for the rest of the year, but that you are engaged in ensuring that the people around you are cared for, that you can engage in mutual aid, that you can organize and ensure that your school boards are well-equipped and are with people who care about the students that are in them. It has this whole ripple effect, movement journalism does. It has a whole ripple effect that ensures that people are going to be more engaged, that people are going to be able to actually fight for the things that they care about. And ultimately, so much of that is going to be for liberation. And there's a very good reason for why movement journalism is severely underfunded. And there's a very good reason for why we're all coming together under either a shared politic or a super similar politic, is so that we can ensure that journalism One is accessible for journalists of color and marginalized people or people who come from lower class and working class backgrounds, but also so that we can retain them for longer periods of time. Journalism is not a very well-paying job. And I can let Maya go into this a little bit further. Some of the plans that we have for the Movement Media Alliance is to ensure that not only is this a job that we love to do, but it's something that intergenerationally will continue to benefit us, our families, the people around us, and our communities.
Maya?
This reality that we sometimes skate around when we're talking about this field, particularly movement media, journalism more broadly, but especially social justice driven media, that being in this field, well, you're doing the work because you love it. So you're not going to think about your salary. You're not going to think about your benefits. You're not going to worry about your retirement or what's going to happen to you if you get really sick. That's not really conducive to being a human being on planet Earth. And so I think that one thing that we're grappling with in coming together is that these issues are real too. And when we talk about sustaining the field, we're not only talking about making sure that our organizations don't go into the red and eventually teeter over and die. It's also about the people involved. And it's about thinking about what kind of field do we want this to be? And how long do we want people to be able to stay in this field as opposed to breaking off and becoming consultants or going into philanthropy or going into academia? No offense, Mickey. These are the real things all of us think about as we approach middle age. And we're like, someday I would like to be not working, because that's just human. And so as we come together, we're talking about what would it look like to develop a shared health insurance pool among movement media so that we can get a good plan for all of us and be taken care of if we get sick. What would it look like to maybe even someday have a movement media pension fund so that all of us can stay in this field with the reassurance that we can someday retire? What would it look like to pool our resources and get some foundational backing for cybersecurity services and ways of keeping ourselves safe in the face of all this repression? And so some of these concrete steps that might not sound super shiny and exciting from the outside are critical pieces of infrastructure for us to be able to maintain this field, grow this field, and stay in it over the long haul.
I couldn't agree more. And what you just said about academia, I'm a rare character in that world. I've been tightroping it for some time now, 25 years. And Project Censored was founded on a campus in John Dewey fashion, that teaching and education is liberating. Critical scholarship is so important. And that's why we talk about critical media literacy. Not corporate, not acritical, not just gadgets and tech, but really interrogating systems of power and enabling and empowering, especially young people, but people of all ages, how to not only interact with media, how to understand and ask questions, but how to be the media. And of course, that's something that I think you're both modeling rather extraordinarily in these efforts. That's no small thing. And that really gets back to what both of you have said earlier, is looking at what the corporate press are and what they do. And yes, they do crib things from the indie media at times. And we applaud when they do, because they have platforms and they're doing their job for a change. But it's just too few and far between. And that's why I've just been very excited about the Media Movement Alliance that you're putting together. And I'm very much looking forward to talking more with you and learning more about it and seeing how we can be part of these solutions moving forward, especially, at least from our angle of Project Censored, we're very interested in infusing critical media literacy, pedagogy, and education into the independent media universe. And I think that you all are pretty hip to that. We've only got a couple minutes left. Laura Witt, let's go to you for those final couple of minutes. Talk to us a little bit about what's coming up. And also, again, please feel free to share any places people can follow you or get in touch and see the amazing work that you do.
I think one of the things that I'd like people to take away from this is that don't let mainstream media make you think that that is what journalism is or that this is what media is. It isn't. There are people who have been doing excellent, amazing, groundbreaking, just earth-shattering work that matters so much to us that has huge ripple effects, not just in people's everyday lives, but also more largely within policy and organizing. So don't get lost in social media itself or even just like weirdly like influencer translated news bites. If you are turned off by mainstream media, go to movement journalism. Look for movement journalism. Look at the Movement Media Alliance. Look at the organizations that are a part of that and support them. Like the only way that we continue to thrive is really with reader loyalty, with their support. And it's a symbiotic relationship. It's one that we should be constantly aware of and nurturing as much as we possibly can.
It's an honor to talk to both of you, and I'm really looking forward to being more part of some of what you're all doing. And I commend you for really trying to do this, because it's something that's really been missing in the independent media world. You mentioned earlier, Maya, about siloing and competing almost, but journalism isn't a sport. We're not competing. It's about collaborating and building these big networks. And both of you are doing an extraordinary job. Maya Shenhua, truthout.org. Laura Witt, prismreports.org, both co-founders of Movement Media Alliance and Media Against Apartheid and Displacement. Thanks to both of you for taking time out of your busy schedules to join us on the Project Censored Show today. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm Mickey Huff, the executive producer and host of the program. Anthony Fest is our longtime senior producer. The Project Censored Show airs on roughly 50 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work at projectcensored.org. Thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens. And the times for the master thief, confine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love of living brothers in our